Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Children everywhere are among the most vulnerable parts of the population, but nowhere more so than in the developing world. Despite exponential increases in modern medicine, children in countries such as Sierra Leone and Bangladesh face diseases long ago eradicated in much of the world. Carol Stern has traveled to many of those troubled places. She's president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, which supports humanitarian work in more than 190 countries around the world. The organization touts its drive toward zero, zero children's deaths from conditions that can be prevented, treated, or cured. It's an effort that underpins Stern's book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, which she'll talk about tonight in Milwaukee. But first, she joins us on the line from UNICEF's Chicago office. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
The book and one of the chapters in the book and really an entire campaign through UNICEF is called I Believe in Zero. How close are we to the zero you are seeking?
Well, you know, today, as we are talking to each other, 18,000 children will die today, all under the age of five, all from causes we already know how to prevent and are just not doing our job. So we're 18,000 away from zero today.
How quickly can we expect changes in the places where UNICEF works? Take, for example, the situation you write about in Sierra Leone, in which a fairly expensive vaccine could make a huge difference in eradicating tetanus. How quickly can change come in a situation like that?
Well, to give you some context, you know, in the 1980s, over 30,000 kids were dying every single day. And so, you know, in the ensuing 30 years, we have halved that number. And the world's population during that period has tripled. So theoretically, if we had done nothing, there would be 90,000 kids dying every day. And when you think about the success rate, it's pretty remarkable. I always say, I wish I had a product that I had made that could show that success rate, because then I could finance what needs to happen for the world's children. So, you know, and in recent years, it's been more accelerated. You know, it isn't like it's a constant coming down every year. It has been more accelerated. So I would hope that in my lifetime, I will see that zero. To take a place like Sierra Leone, you know, the disease of tetanus, it will never be completely eradicated because it's a spore that lives on the ground. But we can eliminate it, and we have successfully eliminated it around the world in all but 20-something countries at this point.
You personally were not necessarily always involved in issues involving the world's children. How long did it take you not just to fully embrace the mission of UNICEF, but to embrace the role that you play in the organization?
You know, I came to UNICEF thinking I knew what it was about. You know, I had had 30 plus years in the nonprofit world, and I could lead any organization. And oh my God, it's kids! I'm so passionate. I took my first trip, and that's where the book starts. I took my first trip to Mozambique, and I was in a clinic in the middle of nowhere with a mom who had just given birth, and you know, I very smiley faced and happy. Young woman, is this your first child? And she so matter-of-factly looked me in the face and said, well, it's the first one that lived. And I, in that moment, realized, you know, I'm not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy, and I really need to take a step back and talk to people and hear what their lives are like and see what their lives are like and touch and feel and experience it myself.
This is not just another nonprofit.
No, it's not. And it's not only just a nonprofit, because of the, you know, the just vast diversity of what UNICEF does every day somewhere in the globe. But it is managed well. It is a well-oiled machine on the one hand, and at the same time able to turn on a dime and be innovative and be tenacious, and is some of the most remarkable people I've ever had the privilege to work with.
You often compare your mission and the circumstances of the children you meet to your own family's experience in the Holocaust and in Nazi-occupied Europe. Why do you see that as such a powerful and appropriate comparison?
Well, you know, because my mom came to this country at the age of 6 years old with her brother, who was four. They were brought here by a woman whose last name they know, but whose first name they never knew, whom they never saw again. And so from a very early age, I learned from my mom repeatedly that one person can make a difference, because I wouldn't be here if not for this woman. And at the same time, my grandfather was on a boat, the SS St. Louis, which is often called the Voyage of the Damned, which wasn't allowed to dock anywhere in the world, and ultimately most of its passengers, you know, it returned to Europe and most of its passengers perished. But my grandfather lived, and I heard his story too. He sat in a harbor outside of Cuba for 40 days while the world debated, what do we do with these people? And everybody, even the U.S., turned, you know, we turned our back on them. And so I also heard very early on what it means to not give a damn, to not be part of the solution. So it's not at all unusual that both my brother and I ended up in giving and caring professions, because that's the lesson we got at home from our earliest stages.
At one point, you reference advice you were given. I think it was going into one of the refugee camps in Darfur, but I might be mistaken. But the advice was you shouldn't promise anything, because the field staff, for as good as it is, might not be equipped to deliver on that promise. It must be hard to see such suffering and at the same time not be able to promise anything specific except that you will try to help.
It's really hard. It's really hard sometimes, even something as silly as knowing I have a bag of Jolly Ranchers in my backpack and there's children in front of me, and I find myself mentally counting, you know, how many kids and how many do I think I have in the bag? Because, you know, you don't want to take it out and give it to one child, right? Something as simple as a piece of candy, and then you multiply that when it's the glass of water that stands between life and death. Or it's the mom you're looking at, you know, straight in the eyes, knowing that 70 cents would have bought the vaccine that would have saved her child, and that you spend more than that on your cup of coffee every morning.
Well, so how do you cope with it?
How do you cope with it? You know, I wish I had a really good answer. The best answer I can give you is some days better than others. You know, people always say to me, how do you not cry? When my response is, what makes you think I don't? You know, I'm not a superhuman, and I definitely cry. I've shed a lot of tears out there. But I also have seen the tenacity of human spirit. I've seen that the children of the world don't see themselves as victims. They're survivors of heroic things and horrific things. And that they believe so dearly that tomorrow could be better that you can't help but get caught up in their optimism.
Well, and I would imagine it would be really easy to have everything you do be driven by guilt of, you know, that you're leaving there at the end of the day or the week, or guilt that you're going home to your family, which, you know, has everything in comparison to the people that you're with.
Yeah, but I will also tell you that there are lots of things in some of the developing nations that we've lost sight of that are remarkable. You know, I talk about it in the book, how I would go to some of the poorest villages, and as the jeeps would drive in, people pour out of their huts and they sing to you, because all they have is to give you is their voice. And I've probably been sung to that way, I don't know, maybe 50 or 100 times now. And that's the time I've never made it without crying. It is the most magnificent sound you will ever hear. Or I went with women who have to go and fetch the water, and that they sing and dance their way to the river, and there's a sense of community that I don't feel in my hometown that is remarkable. None of these make up for or replace the things that they need, but there are things we can learn from these people. And I guess that's the big lesson for me in all of this, is I came in thinking I knew it. I realized I knew nothing. And I never really had thought about before I took the job how much I would learn as I went through it all.
One of the other really powerful recurrent images is this idea that pretty much everywhere you have gone, there are scenes of children really just being children.
Oh, absolutely. I always said there were three things that have been the same no matter where I go. And the first is that wherever there are kids, there is some kind of ball. You know, I mean, it's like man is inherently, you know, we have to play with a ball because, you know, in the U.S., it's leather, it's plastic, and in most of the nations I go to, it's rags tied with string. But in absolutely every place I've ever been, some kid is kicking it and some kid is kicking it back, and they're laughing. Or when a baby is born, no matter how poor the family is, that baby's healthy, there is rejoicing. And there is love. It's amazing. So one is the ball. The second is that my lap is not my property. You know, if I sit on the ground long enough in any place in the world, a kid is going to come and sit on me. It's phenomenal. They don't speak my language. They don't ask permission. They just kind of plop down. And it feels just as good anywhere in the world to have a kid who you don't know feel safe with you. But the third thing is that we all want the same things for our kids. We want them to be happy. We want them to be healthy. We want them to go to bed with their bellies full. We want them to dream really, really, really big dreams, and we want to be part of making those dreams come true.
Do you also see a takeaway message for people, you know, living in cities in this country, places like Milwaukee, where there are also crises in children's health, things like infant mortality and really similar situations where otherwise preventable diseases are, if not common, certainly more common in these places than they are in more affluent communities?
Well, I think that if a child suffers, no matter where what their geography is, it's horrible. So it isn't a matter of which place is worse. It shouldn't be an either. It's an and. But there are some advantages in the United States. When a child is born in the U.S., even a migrant child, the child gets a birth certificate. They exist. There's some record of their existence. We have laws that define them as a child until they reach 18. Education is not a privilege in this country. It's a law and it's a right. You know, you're mandated to go. So there's public schools without fees. In order to go to those schools, you have to be immunized, so immunizations are made available to children. There is a shelter system. No hospital will turn a baby that's dying away. There is all kinds of things that we have that the developing world does not have.
So even as you're trying to do things to directly impact children's health, provide vaccines and make these changes, is it also UNICEF's role to work behind the scenes to try to pressure these countries into making policy changes like something as simple as birth certificates?
Absolutely. You know, we work upstream as well as downstream. So we work to get school fees eliminated. We work to get birth registries in place. You know, I'll go back to Haiti. After the earthquake, the first night, the main thing that I needed to do was to go out and try and get as many digital cameras as I could possibly get my hands on. And then when I flew into Haiti, we were literally taking pictures of kids and creating registries because children got separated from their families, and it was many weeks till you knew who was dead, who was alive, where people were. And you had a lot of people trying to claim children were theirs who weren't theirs. And so we started to create registries there. So sometimes we're actually doing it. Sometimes we are working to abolish school fees. You know, all over Africa, we've had school fees abolished in many countries, making it possible for a poor child to go to school.
Have you gotten any better at dealing with bugs?
No. I want to say yes, but my kids will tell you no. I'm still like that woman who stands on the chair when the spider's on the floor. No, I haven't. I hate things that crawl. When I was getting ready to go to Sudan, and I went through this entire security training class, and I was fine when I was learning, you know, what do you do if they want to take your Jeep? What do you do if somebody wants to shoot at you? I mean, I was really fine on all of that. And then we got to the, how do you shake your sleeping bag out to make sure there's no scorpion? And I almost didn't go on the trip.
Well, Carol Stern, we will try to keep the bugs out of Milwaukee while you are here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's why I like to travel much better in the winter.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and the story of UNICEF with us.
Well, thank you so much. And if anyone is interested, unicefusa.org, you can find out lots of information about how to get involved.
Carol Stern is the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF and author of the book I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, published by St. Martin's Press. She'll talk about her work this evening in a conversation that I'll be moderating at the Milwaukee Public Library. There is more information about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Children in Milwaukee once formed a powerhouse soccer club called Simbas. The club folded a few years back but is making perhaps an underdog comeback. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.